If you are looking for life and career enhancements, you need experts that have been there, done that, tried, sometimes failed, and ultimately succeeded. Welcome to The Business of Living with Scott Ventrella. You may be looking for help with relationships, health and wellness, home life, career, finance, or faith. We hopefully have the answers you are seeking. Now, here is your host, Scott Ventrella.
Welcome to the show. Hey, listen, my guess is that those listening in are, and I hope this is true, that you are gainfully employed. And I certainly know the stats on unemployment. So, although that is, you know, slowly ticking to the more positive side, let's say, there are many people that are underemployed, or those, you know, I'd like to think of this a little bit more positively, those who are gainfully employed. Whatever your situation, I think that it's always important to think about career and how to get ahead. It's interesting. Yesterday, I was with a client down in Dallas, and I was talking to them. Actually, the subject in this particular case was parenting and raising kids, and he was talking about, hey, you know, Scott, now he's got teenagers, and he said, you know, Scott, when the baby was born and they handed the baby over to me, they didn't give me the manual. And having two kids myself, I find that to be true. Now, you're probably thinking, okay, well, what does this have to do with managing your career? Well, fortunately, managing your career, there actually is, I think there are some really good guidelines. I don't think there's any one manual, but I do believe that there are some very, very practical guidelines. And, you know, a lot of people don't make themselves available to it. And therefore, you know, they'll tend to flounder. We all have, you know, certain blind spots. That is, you know, we don't know what we don't know. How successful have you been in managing your career? I started my career a few decades ago. Let's put it that way. And I was fortunate enough to have a champion. I had a mentor. I had people who had taken an interest. And I'll give myself a little bit of credit. You know, I did want to get ahead. I really did not know the rules of the road. I did not have a guidebook, if you will. But again, I happen to be fairly fortunate. You know, my first job was with a consulting firm back in the early 1980s, and I started out bottom rung, and I mean bottom rung down in the old shipping room. I don't think that happens anymore. That might all be automated for all I know. Think Amazon. But seriously, I thought, well, you know, I'll probably last a couple of years in this job, and without going through all of the details, that turned out to be an 11-year career, a wonderful career. I was able to climb the proverbial ladder in every respect, both in, you know, status, compensation. I enjoyed the work. And again, I was fortunate enough to have a champion. I was fortunate enough to have people who cared enough about me to point out, you know, mistakes that I had made and how to improve myself. We all make missteps. We all have made mistakes, and sometimes we think that they are mistakes that we cannot overcome. I believe that most anything that we do can be overcome if we have the proper guidance. And you know, unless you commit some egregious error or mistake, that, you know, I'm not talking about that. So today we're going to explore. I refer to them as three critical ingredients. So I'm not going to give you the whole guidebook. We could spend every week talking about career and how to manage and navigate career success. But today I'm going to explore three critical ingredients for managing your career success. And they are, and we're going to really run through them in this particular order. It's all about understanding yourself, how to deal with others, that is your peers, direct reports, and then finally, you know, managing the old boss, and I don't mean old as in, you know, old, an old guy or gal, but managing up, and I'm sure you're familiar with that term. You know, the point is, we've got to get this straight. These are almost the fundamentals, in my view, getting to know ourselves, dealing with others, and then, very importantly, how to manage up. And that's not sucking up, okay? I just want to be clear on that. This is all about managing up. So I'm really pleased to introduce our guest today, who's going to help guide us through this journey. His name is John C. Ford. John, we could probably skip the C. I know he's probably already thinking, why did he say that? John is a dear friend, and equally, if not, I shouldn't say if not more importantly, but equally important, John is, I consider him an expert in this area. John has, well, we'll just say this, you know, 20 plus years. I'll be gentle here. 20 plus years as an executive coach, leadership development, management consultant. Although I don't use that term anymore because, you know, management consultant often has a negative connotation. You know, we give advice that oftentimes is ignored if the individual on the inside tries to give that advice. But the only difference is we get all the glory and we get usually paid fairly well. I'm being, of course, facetious here. So, John, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Scott. Pleasure to be here, and nice to be with you again on radio.
Yeah.
I love what you had to say about the parenting manual, because I think we all wish we'd had one, and you learn by doing, obviously. So that's, I think, what today is about.
So is it accurate to say that unlike parenting, which you never know what you're going to get, I think with managing career success, it seems as though it's a little bit more predictable. You know, I think there are guidelines. I think there are rules of the road. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, it is a fair statement. And I think I use the analogy of a personality or motivation as being like an anchor that's in the water. That's probably been there for each one of us from the time that we were very young. But the anchor is almost always connected to a buoy. And it's the buoy that moves around. So if you look at the buoy as how we behave, the behavior is often associated with how we respond to ourselves, how we respond to other people, those in authority, those in our peer. But that anchor remains pretty much the same. And I thought this morning or this afternoon we could probably spend some time talking about some of those anchors and how we sort of act out against what our beliefs and our personalities are. So I think that's a good way to head across.
So before we get into that, so executive coach, now I do some of this, and, you know, people who have used executive coaches, they kind of get it. Mm-hmm. People who are not that familiar, let's face it, very candidly, some people think, well, you know, what is this? Is this real? And if people just can't do their job, then, you know, they don't need a coach. They just need another job. They need to be somewhere else because we're paying them enough money to be able to do their job without having to bring in one of these fancy executive coaches. So what is it exactly that an executive coach does? I'm assuming that that's not all of what you do, but it's a part of what you do.
I would say it's helping people to understand who they are and how to be the best at what they do. The kind of coaching that I don't do with people who are in trouble. I tend to do it with people who are on their way up. And every now and then in large organizations, the higher you go, the less people you're able to talk to about those things that really matter. You find yourself amongst a group of peers, all of whom are essentially competing with one another. And every now and then it's important to sort of step outside that circle, that very, very familiar circle, and talk to somebody on the outside who is objective and maintains a high degree of confidentiality who can, in fact, give you some advice.
And I've also found you're right that I deal often with you know, the proverbial C-suite CEOs and the like, and it is, you know, the old saying, it's lonely at the top. It really is, and they don't have people that they can talk to for a lot of different reasons. You know, one is their position, I find, but also, you know, often the things that they'd like to be able to discuss are very highly confidential.
Right.
So they may be thinking about, you know, an acquisition or putting the company up for sale or some, you know, big strategic move. They simply can't talk to anybody really about it. They are bound to confidentiality. Obviously, with executive coaches, most all of us are asked to sign, you know, a confidentiality agreement. And they can almost, it's almost as if it's like a fiduciary arrangement, for instance, using an attorney. Not exactly the same, but it's very similar. And I know that, you know, a professional like yourself, you take that extremely seriously. Also, though, I find that, you know, executives, and even, you know, we're broadening this, but most people, let's say, you know, managers, supervisors, executives, they really don't want to take it home either.
Right.
Oftentimes, the spouse doesn't want to hear it. They don't want to hear about the complaining. Hey, look, you've got to fix it. You know, oftentimes there'll be a good listening ear. But a couple things. Again, they don't want to bring it home. And also, usually friends and family are not necessarily in the best position to give the best possible advice.
I think that's very true. And I think that there's also this concept of the seal of the confessional. Whatever I learn in a coaching session, I maintain that confidentiality. And I always let my coachee know that in advance so that he or she feels trustworthy and they feel that they can express things that they otherwise couldn't express. I'm very fortunate. My best coach is my wife. So in my particular case, she's a college professor, and at night we sit home and we talk about the various issues of the day. We spend about 20 or 30 minutes sort of debriefing from the day, and I've always found that to be very helpful. But she also raised a family, and she also has a job, and you know, it's important for her to have some kind of outlet where she can talk. So it's a nice kind of interface. I also find that the personalities of the motivations I talked about before move very nicely between the boardroom and the bedroom. There's not a lot of difference in our personalities and motivations between how we are at home and how we are at the office. So, you know, if you want to find out how people really are, ask their subordinates and then ask their wives or husbands, and they will tell you.
good advice. Let's start now with, in terms of, you know, managing career success. You mentioned, number one, understanding yourself. So where and how do we begin this process?
Well, let me take you back a little bit. At the turn of the last century, there were three guys who were particularly well known as some of the fathers of modern behavior theory or personality, and they were Jung, Adler, and Freud, all well-known psychologists. They really sort
sounds
of
sounds like a law firm. Jung, Adler, and Freud. Are you sure you're not mistaken?
Well, yeah. Carl Jung, amongst those three, Carl Jung was one of the guys in the 30s, 40s, and 50s who was able to identify the connection between personality, motivation, and behavior. And the work that he did led on to a lot of sort of tests and overviews of personality that have been used in business. We're going to talk today about social styles, but also the Myers-Briggs type inventory, which is a very popular form of self-analysis.
Yeah, that mother-daughter team, Myers and Briggs, they were, they really studied and followed, Jungian, let's say, principles. And I think they were responsible for, back in the, I may be wrong, but back in the, 1940s?
Correct.
Pulling that together. And I believe the initiative was to help, initially, Myers-Briggs type indicator to help figure out what were the best jobs for women that could help out, during the war effort. Obviously, at that time, they could not be in combat.
Well, it's now universally accepted as a great tool for businesses to use because of the work that Isabel Myers-Briggs did and her daughter, and has led on to sort of items and like DISC and insights and social styles. All of that really flows out of that original
research. Out of Myers-Briggs, yeah. And some people, some people, they look at Myers-Briggs, and I'm generalizing here, but there's some that will say, it's okay, but it's a little flimsy. I don't necessarily agree. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's a good starting point. I think everything is a good starting point. What the Myers-Briggs inventory does is it breaks us down into 16 different, quite different styles. Social styles, which we'll talk about in a minute, is much easier. It's in four basic quadrants in which you can sort of identify in 80% of the cases where somebody's motivation sits, and also gives you some tools that you can use to identify and also to be kind of flexible with those people. I find the Myers-Briggs to be a very good tool after somebody is hired to help them to identify their career goals and to help them ensure that their career is in line with their values and their beliefs. I would not use it as a tool to hire people because it talks about personality, and quite frankly, in many cases, that's against the law. Mm-hmm. So we have to be very careful in terms of using any of these instruments, and that's what they are, as a means to hire, fire, et cetera. It's just not a good thing to do because the degree of accuracy on these things is always going to be somewhat questionable, but they're very, very good guidelines.
Yeah, and I agree with that, and that's a good reminder to everybody most effective once you're in the job. I especially like it also, though, not only understanding about yourself, and I know this is going to be coming up in our second segment, but also how we interact with others. Once we know, and I've done this where you're having problems, let's say a company might be having problems with a co-leadership situation, and I'll use, again, like you said, it's a baseline. It's a nice starting point. And you find out, my gosh, these two couldn't be further apart personality-wise. And then, at least it begins what I think is understanding, a dialogue, and then trying to move to close the gap and really making adjustments in personality versus some people say, well, my gosh, this is who I am. It is true, but do I have to change and be somebody else? I say, no, you just have to, if you want to be successful, you have to learn how to make, you know, the appropriate adjustments. We'll get to that when we get, I'm sure, into dealing with
others. Yeah, we need to learn to be flexible. And as I said before, you know, it's boardroom to the bedroom. I married a woman who's exactly the opposite type to me. And we've had 20 years.
It works.
It works
for how many months?
She's quite analytical, and, you know, like you, I'm very expressive. I'm out there. You know, people know exactly where I stand, and you really have to work at it to kind of find out where my wife stands.
And so, John, this marriage has worked for how many months?
Years, please. 20 years, he proudly says. Well,
okay,
let me get into a couple of particulars
please,
here that might be helpful, Scott, because the research that Jung did really ended up talking about two dimensions of interactive behavior. The degree to which somebody has very high emotions, which are very visible, and the degree, on the other hand, to which those people are much more controlled, much more, I wouldn't say shut down, but much more in charge of their emotions. So you have somebody who is quite controlling on the one hand, and on the other hand, you have somebody who's very emotive. So that's one sort of way of looking at personality differences. And then you have another, which is people who are reserved in terms of their affect and like to ask a lot of questions. And on the other side of that, people who are less reserved and more apt to tell. So you have the ask on one side, the tell on the other, and then at the top and the bottom, you've got high control, and on the bottom, high emote. So you've got those four diagnostics kind of working in there, and this is the basis of the social styles model. And what the research seems to say, and a lot of this, by the way, came out of work that was done long after Freud and Jung and Adler and even Myers-Briggs and Tracom and many other companies have delved into this. But you have four basic operating styles. And it doesn't mean that you're solely or completely any one of those styles. It means that you have one that's a preference. That's that anchor in the water that I talked about before. But somebody who knows this well can, in fact, begin to move that buoy around, which is to say they can become more flexible and more adaptable by recognizing when they're dealing with other people what they need to do. So the old saying is, before you get to know others, you need to know yourself. And I would recommend to your listeners that one of the things that they might want to do is go right into their web browser and to punch in social styles. And what they will find is a variety of self-tests, 20, 30, 40 questions, in which after they answer those questions, they're able to identify their prevailing style.
So then again, John, once they understand their prevailing style, so give an example of one of the styles, and so what do we take away from that? We've got about a minute or so before the break.
Well, one of those styles would be the driver, and that's somebody who has a high need for control but also is very open in terms of how they feel. So the driver is a pretty independent thinker, fairly practical, rather formal, values actions and results, get the job done. That seems to be his or her mantra. Then you've got somebody who is very emotive, but also on the tell side, and we call that person very expressive. They're animated, they're forceful, they're emphatic, they like to talk a lot, you like to be with them, they're apt to say, what's the big idea here? Then on the other side, you have somebody who's low ask and high control, and we would call that person an analytical. Somebody who's serious, somebody who's exacting, somebody who's logical, likes figures and data. Let's do it right the first time. That might be their mantra. So, and then you've got somebody who's low in assertiveness, but fairly high in emote. And we call that person amiable. They become dependent, open, expressive. They value security. They value relationships. Let's talk about the impact of our people would be their mantra. So you've got these four styles.
So, John, I'm sorry to interrupt. We're going to have to go to a break. But hold that thought, because I do want to get a little bit into each one of those. But first, we do have to go to a break. When we return, we're going to continue to talk about how do you manage your career success. We're talking about how to first understand yourself, then deal with others, especially when it comes to conflict. By the way, if you'd like to join the show, please call us at 866-472-5788. We'll be right back.
Streaming live, the leader in Internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com. If you are interested in real estate in America's largest city or anywhere, be sure to listen for Good Morning New York Real Estate with Vince Rocco. Although our focus is on Manhattan and other real estate markets in and around New York City, we'll have plenty of information that will help you successfully buy, sell, and close a transaction no matter where you are in the world. Good Morning New York, Real Estate with Vince Rocco can be heard every Tuesday at 9 a.m. in New York, 6 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
The world we live in has become a crazy place. Poverty is at an all-time high in the wealthiest nation on earth. We keep calling on government to save us with new programs. And now, we have more people using food stamps than any time in our history. This problem continues to get worse. The answer to poverty is in our homes, churches, and communities, and through our children. Get the answers from the Mickey Ellison Show, Wednesdays at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, 11 a.m. Eastern, on Voice America Variety.
We all love our best friend, especially when that best friend is a canine best friend. Now there's a show just for the dogs, or the people who love them. Tune in to Dogs Rock Radio with host Pamela Hill. With your stories and advice from the experts, we'll show just how much love and purpose dogs bring to our lives and others around us. You'll also learn about canine fitness, training, and health and wellness. Make Dogs Rock Radio a weekly stop every Monday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on Voice America Variety.
The Internet's number one talk station. Number one talk station. VoiceAmerica.com.
This is The Business of Living with Scott Ventrella. To reach the show today, call in to 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. You may also send an email to scott@thebusinessofliving.com. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back. We're here with Executive Coach John Ford, and we're talking about how to get ahead in your career. As we were just discussing before the break, how to manage, you know, oneself in a sense. And John, you were talking about, in terms of social styles, the expressive, driver, analytical, amiable. So let's say, you know, pick any one of those. They all sound like they could work to our favor, but I'm also thinking that, you know, if you've got around the table and you're trying to accomplish a task, let's say if you've got one of each, I would imagine there could be a little bit of headbutting. So talk a little bit about that. What are some of the pros and the cons of each one of those types?
And it's absolutely true, by the way, that when you have those four types, by the way, you have a very good team. And it's a very good team when they understand each other and when they can appreciate what each person brings to the party. For instance, the expressive. And if you were looking for a model for an expressive, take a look at some of our presidents. JFK and FDR were two of the great rhetoricians of all time. And they were certainly expressive and liked it. The best traits of those kinds of people is they're honest, sincere, supportive, friendly, and sociable, but they can also be perceived as naive or smothering or demanding or snooping. So in order to get the best out of the expressive, one of the things that somebody like that needs to do is to allow them to have the opportunity to talk and to talk about things that involve people. Relationship always dominates content with an expressive. On the other hand, you've got the driver. You know, the driver is direct, competitive, excitable, fast, decisive, and challenging. And I'd put LBJ or Nixon in those two categories if you want sort of a model from our history. And they were also perceived on the other side of that as pretty harsh, fairly aggressive, inflexible, and argumentative, if you remember all the controversy during the Nixon administration. Then you've got these group of the people we call the analyticals. You know, they're independent, they're rigorous, they're self-contained, they're thorough, they're pretty accurate, and if it's worth doing, it's worth doing right. If you wanted a model for that, maybe Woodrow Wilson, who was extremely analytical, had been a college professor at Princeton and was perceived as looking at things in a very insightful way. Calvin Coolidge, Silent Cal, might also be put in that category, too. They can be perceived as aloof, a little nitpicky, a bit cold, a little long-winded, maybe fussy. Mm-hmm. And then you've got the amiable. And the one that I would say was probably the best model for that was Jimmy Carter. Who else could have brought, Egypt and Israel together at the table? His best traits there are flexibility, collaboration, mediation, adaptability. On the other side, they can be seen as political, all-pleasing, convictionless, master of none. So you've got the good and the bad of all four of these styles. And the secret, of course, is being able to understand that about the people you were with and to be able to play to it. In other words, to be flexible. If you stick too much to your own guns and to your own style, the chances are that you're not going to be successful. But to be successful.
Okay, so I'm going to put you on the spot here. How would you define, under you know, using these labels, our current president, President Obama?
I would call him fairly expressive. His foremost desire is for a degree of harmony. That's one of the things that he's really looking for. He's trying very hard right now to sort of bring various parties together in the Middle East. He's attempting at the same time to deal with the crisis, the Ebola crisis. Definitely not a driver. He tends to take things fairly quietly, a little bit analytical. And by the way, I would say that there's no one person who's purely one of these things.
Exactly. So let's, with that as a starting point, thank you, by the way. So we talk about, in terms of managing career, I completely agree. We've got to understand ourselves. We've got to understand what our motives, values, our interests, our passions, and our personality, and kind of what we're all about. So we've shared a couple of, I think, excellent tools. You know, Myers-Briggs can also be, done online. You talk about the social styles. So yes. Just Google that, and you'll find some good material there. Now let's talk about, so now we understand a little bit more about ourselves. And as we know, we live, interdependent lives. So now we're in the workplace. Let's talk a little bit about how can we more effectively deal with others. And I think especially, look, there's a lot of conflict and disagreement in the workplace. So mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about that, please.
Well, people make decisions for their reasons and not ours. So what we need to do is to understand what best we can about them. And so when we're dealing particularly with our peers where we don't have control over them, and you have to remember that influence is the ability to get things done through people over whom we have no direct control. So we'll talk about the boss later, but when I'm dealing with a peer in the marketplace, somebody that's at the same level as me, maybe somebody that I quietly am competing with,
I'm sorry, I think that's worth underscoring. Mm-hmm. It's the proverbial moose in the room. No one's going to say it. Okay, it's all about teamwork. It's all about collaboration. Oftentimes, the performance system, the performance management system, compensation, et cetera, really does pit ourselves against others. And especially if we are trying to climb that ladder, it's an unspoken thing. Again, the proverbial moose, put it on the table. Understand that, I think to a degree we're all a little bit like this. I think we all have a degree of competition. Ask any golfer, by the way, if you don't believe in competition, then the next time you go out golfing, throw away the scorecard, see how far that gets you.
Exactly.
But I think that, the idea that we are competing with others, and we might as well just acknowledge it, and I don't mean necessarily directly to that our peers' face, but, understand that. You just want to get that out and be aware of that. And understand what that dynamic is all about.
Well, I'm working with a company right now that is moving from a calibration system where they did a sort of a bell curve. People at the very top get rewarded, then there's the mighty folks in the middle who are at the top of the curve, and then the people at the bottom, the low 5%. Mm-hmm. And that was very typical in American companies for a long, long time.
Well, GE had the vitality curve. You knock off the 10%, the bottom 10% performers, each year, more or less.
I'd say, Scott, that a lot of companies are dropping that because it creates so much competition
and
so much angst.
Yeah.
So
mm-hmm.
This is a company that's moving from calibration to something that is a much better and easier performance management system to work, where there's not that fear that if I end up at the bottom, I'm out. They'll give me my pink slip. Mm-hmm. But there is the reality that when we go into a marketplace, we very often are perceived to be competing with our peers for, if not for promotions, at least for favor, for attention. And when you're dealing with your peers in an organization, the only tool that you have to work with is your ability to influence them, to get them to do things over which they have or you have no control. You want them to come to your side of the coin. You want them to understand on a team, for instance, what's best for the team, and to have them sort of bypass their personal interests. And that's not easy to do.
Yeah, and you're also trying to avoid, escalating this up to the boss, because in my view, that's the last thing you want to do is bring another problem to your boss. So, to try to deal directly with the individual. So go ahead, please.
Yeah, well, we find that there are four or five techniques that people tend to use that can get them to influence their peers. There are quite a few of them, but there are four or five that are very strong. And one of them is very common. It's the one that we tend to use as parents to children. It's reason. you know, we should go on with this option because it gives the best return on our investment, would say a businessman. A parent to a child would say, you need to do this in order to get ahead in school. So there has to be an end result that the person you're attempting to influence understands and can grasp onto. The effect that it has on the other person is they see that your proposal is likely to achieve their objectives. So one of the things a good influencer wants to do is to make sure that we're stating all the facts, that we outline the pros and cons, that we ask them for their point of view so that they feel more collaborative, explain what the concerns will be. Then there's another one, which is also quite popular, and we see this constantly. It's inspiration. These are people who work very effectively because the boss or the company has a very strong vision, a very strong strategy of some type. They're enthused by the appeals to their values, their ideals, and their inspiration. If you go back to the civil rights era, it was the concept of I have a dream, you know, and people need to buy into that dream. So as an influencer, you would want to use that kind of inspirational facility that you may have.
Even though you're not the, let's say, the legitimate leader, CEO, I think what you're saying is no matter where you are in the organization, you know, if in a sense, if you're trying to push your product, right, your idea,
right,
make sure you wrap it around something that is something that people can get a little bit excited about. They can, they can get enthusiastic about and kind of get behind you on.
Yeah, something that's noble and greater than ourselves. Something mm-hmm. that for the common good. And that's one of the company. One of the reasons why when you walk into company headquarters, you'll often see carved in stone, literally, or carved in brass, an inspirational vision of some type mm-hmm. in terms of what we believe. And that's the thing that, again, as we say, the companies like J&J and Merck and other people, we make medicine for the people, not for the profits. That's a very inspirational statement.
And again, though, here we're talking about, you know, pretty much anybody, even at the local level, can have, let's say it's a vision, small v, or, you know, micro vision that maybe ties up into the overall. But again, trying to influence others, especially when you don't have that legitimate authority over them, then informally, you know, to sell them on the idea with let's say the bigger picture and the meaning or the why behind it, let's say.
I'll tell you a story. In fact, it's a very famous story. When the Government Services Administration was looking at NASA when it was first created, they did a swing through the NASA headquarters and talked to people at every level. And the most interesting interview that they conducted was at about 2:00 in the morning on the floor of the cafeteria, where there was a guy pushing a broom across the floor. He was a janitor, and they said, "Tell us what you're doing." And he looked at the guy who was the researcher and said, "I'm putting a man on the moon."
Ah, love it.
So, you know, even at the lowest level
even
of an organization.
Even at the janitor level, right? Yeah.
Yeah, this guy got the fact that they were trying to put a man on the moon. And that was, but that's what kept him inspired. He kept pushing that broom.
So let me ask you this. You mentioned in terms of influencing your peers, you know, reason, inspiration. I know there's a couple of others. But what if you're working with a jerk? What if they don't appeal? You know, we use analogies often with the kids, right?
Mm-hmm.
You've got kids that are they're competing for mom and dad's attention, or they'll play one parent off of the other. What if you just have somebody that you're working with that is not reasonable, quite frankly? You know, they've got personal problems. They're emotional problems, whatever it might be that they're bringing into the office. You're dealing with somebody that does not where reason, you know, it just doesn't appeal to them. And in fact, you know, inspiring, if anything, you know, they're just even more cynical.
Well, cynicism is hard to get by, and cynicism, you have to find out what that's coming from. I would be to my mother's old trick, which was I never inspired to do the dishes, but in front of company, my mother would announce, "You know, my son John is so good at doing the dishes. He does a better job than any of my kids. He is just remarkable. You could learn a lot from him." The next thing I know, I've got a dish towel in my hand. So that's the old feel-good thing where you're making them feel good, and it makes them think more highly of you, make them more open to persuasion. When you say, "You know, the report that you did last month, it really, really made a difference in terms of our outcome. I would love to have you on my team, and I'd love to have that same result. How do you feel about that?"
Okay. I like that.
Sounds a little bit manipulative, but
yeah, okay. You read my mind, but that's fair. That's fair. It's all, you know, it's with the right intention. So you mentioned in terms of influencing your peers to reason with them, look at the end result, throw in some inspiration. You know, what is the vision? Try to stoke up that enthusiasm. What are some others?
Well, one is good old-fashioned deal. I'll scratch your back if you scratch mine.
Ah, quid pro quo.
So, you know, I've got this report to do, and it's due by Friday, and I'm under the gun to get this other thing done. Gee, can you handle the figures on that? If you do that, I'll take care of your report next week.
Mm.
Or I've got to get my expense report in. You know, I'll help you with yours if you help me with mine. So, again, it's the, you know, if you come and join us, you'll get a bonus sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And another one, Scott, very frankly, is just to ask.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we bypass that. We've talked about reason, inspiration, feeling good, and deal. But good old-fashioned ask. I mean, they're reassured that you're willing to adapt their views in order to take into account how they view about things. So the way that you do that is say, you know, I'd really like you to join my team, but I need your input.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think this thing ought to be done? So that in essence, what you're doing is you're asking for their input and assuring them through the process that you're going to involve them in the solution. And that makes them feel good. You know, the advertisers use this all the time. Let's take this one. Do you have a credit card? Do you get reward points? Do you use your points? Would you rather have a credit card that gives you cash? Do you have 5 minutes to get the card that gives you cash? I mean, advertisers use this all the time.
That's right.
And
well, getting to yes. If you get, you know, get them to say yes 5 or 6 times, you're there.
Yeah. And there's another one like it, which we call silent allies. Everybody assumes that everybody else has got to do it, so they've got to do it. 50 million Americans invest in U.S. savings bonds. Drive a little slower, everybody else does. Drive a little faster, everybody else does. You know,
that's good.
And,
that's
good. You know, I find in corporations, I ask the question, why are we doing this? Well, because we've always done it.
Right.
You know, that's
so,
it has
so
no reason attached to it,
yeah.
But it's like everybody's been doing this for years and
it's
years.
The way we've been doing it.
That's
yeah.
the way we've been doing it. You know?
And,
so
you, know,
you sort of salute smartly and say,
yeah.
I don't want to be outside the you know the pale on this one.
So also in dealing with others, and this will be a good lead in and after we take the break. But another, I think another issue in dealing with others effectively is that let's say your peer is reporting into a different boss, and now you've got that kind of so you've got let's say conflicting goals or directives, and let's say even your bosses aren't really getting your respective bosses aren't getting along. I have found you know conflict in the workplace when in fact you know you're asking them you know can you help me out, can you be part of this team, and they're thinking well gee you know I've got enough on my plate, my boss if I agree to that. You know, I'm going to get, you know, beat up for that. Any thoughts on that? We've got about a minute before the break.
Yeah, I would get together with the other person where there's a conflict and say, let's see if we can work this out together. And if we can't, let's make a proposal together to the two bosses.
Mm-hmm.
So that, in essence, we're presenting not a problem, but a potential solution. And I find that in organizations, if you bring the boss a solution, by the way, you're 50% more likely to get what you want. If you're just seen as the guy who brings the problems in or the gal brings the problems in, they don't want to deal with it after a while. It's the, you know, the boy who cried wolf.
I know that, you know, people listening in understand that, but I don't know if truly it is understood how important that is. Because, again, as I've kind of, let's say, matured in my career, that is, the, you know, longer I've been in the workplace and also doing this kind of work, I know that... bosses they don't want to be bothered. You know, they don't want more problems because that's all they deal with really is problems. So, you know, if you really want to be effective in managing your career, don't go to your boss with problems. That's the last thing you want to do. Go to them with you may not have the answer, mm-hmm. but maybe go with 2 or 3 possible solutions. And in this case, you know, if you've got a peer. Maybe you collectively, you know, present something to him or her that, and more than one option. I was just meeting with somebody yesterday where I said, look, don't just give one option. Give them, and it may be even a hybrid. At
sure.
least 2, I would even suggest 3. And actually, this is a nice lead into the next segment coming up, which will be, and I think this is extremely critical, but it's how to manage the boss, whether they're, you know, a superstar kind of a boss or, you know, one of those horrible bosses or something in between. I know we've all dealt with one or the other or in between. But when we come back after the break, we're going to be talking about how to manage up. Now, I said manage up, not suck up, manage up to be more effective in your career. If you want to join the show, by the way, please do call 866-472-5788, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Stay stimulating talk.
It gets those synapses in the brain firing really fast.
All the time. The number one internet talk station where your opinion counts. VoiceAmerica.com.
All round the outermost rim of the shield, he set the mighty stream of the river Oceanus, creating Achilles' shield in Homer's The Iliad, Book 18.
Rachel Carson, in The Sea Around Us, said, "All at last, return to the sea, to Oceanus, the ocean river, like the ever-flowing stream of time, the beginning and the end." Moyer's Environmental Dialogues with Dr. Rob Moyer offers lively dialogue and revealing narrative inquiry into how individuals are overcoming obstacles and creating a greener and blue planet Earth. Tune in Thursdays at 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 noon Pacific on the Voice America Variety Channel.
What if there was a radio show that could demonstrate how we can cut your taxes in half without diminishing needed government services? One that could explain how to create tens of millions of jobs at no cost to taxpayers, as well as fantastic yet easily affordable health care. Side effects include cutting crime rates nationwide, providing better education for our children, international peace and harmony, and protecting your private personal data from government intrusion. Tune in to Libertarians Working for You with Arvind Vora, weekdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 11 a.m. Pacific, on Voice America Variety.
Streaming live, the leader in internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com.
This is The Business of Living with Scott Ventrella. To reach the show today, call in to 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. You may also send an email to scott@thebusinessofliving.com. Now, back to the show.
Okay, so thank you for coming on back. I think we're getting to some juicy stuff now. It's all about, you know, managing up, managing the boss. And we're here speaking with John Ford. He's an executive coach, a leadership development expert, org design, org development expert, et cetera. You know, when I think about managing up, for most of my career, you know, I was, let's say, you know, the employee. I wasn't really supervising or managing. But the first time I was promoted into an executive position, I was the executive vice president. I was promoted, and by the way, I was promoted amongst my peers, and it was somewhat unexpected. Actually, this is one of those things where I really didn't want it. I wasn't looking for it. My peers were. And, you know, the president at the time came to me and said, "Hey, look, we'd like you to do the job." And I was flattered, and of course I accepted it. But here's the funny thing, is one of my peers, this was maybe on a Friday, so it was on a Monday when the announcement was made. One of my peers came into my office, and by the way, up until that point, was pretty standoffish, you know, really didn't, you know, go out of his way to socialize or to even stop by to say hello, you know, come by my office, et cetera. So here it is Monday morning, the announcement's made, and he presents me with a bottle of single malt scotch, you know, as a congratulations, and I'm thinking, oh boy, in the back of my mind I'm thinking, okay, what is it that he wants now that I'm the boss? I know that's not very nice, but I shouldn't think that way, but it was just too coincidental. You know, after all that time, you know, here he is now presenting me with a really nice, you know, thank you or congratulatory gift. So anyway, John, good to have you back on the show to continue our discussion on getting ahead in your career. Okay, managing the boss. I think I'm waiting with eager anticipation because
I hope you kept a single malt scotch. I mean, I hope that was you considered that a real prize.
It was a good choice. I'm not sure you know how he knew I liked that, but I thought it was a pretty good choice. So yeah, he got a few points for that. It was a very nice gesture. Yeah. So whether you're working, so let's just talk about it. You just jump right in wherever you want.
Well, I'll tell you what it is. It's not really about the boss. It's about how we view power. And it ties into the influence discussion we had before and the self-styles of power is more evident in some relationships than it is in others. And so we very often will imbue the boss, whether he or she, old or young, with qualities that they may or may not have. But one's individual power comes from, you know, a dependency, a competencies, a level of control, their influence, et cetera. There's a lot of research that's been done. In fact, a few years ago, 400 very senior managers, i.e. the bosses of other senior managers, were asked, quite frankly, what they want from their senior managers. And the bosses had this to say, and I thought it was very interesting, Scott. They're looking for their people to develop their interpersonal skills. They're looking for the direct reports to gain experience and to run something. They're looking for the folks who report to them to sharpen their image and to act like a leader. And this is interesting. They're looking for their people to actually talk to them, not be afraid of them. They're looking for their people to clarify where they are going. And they're looking for their people to provide accurate numbers so you don't bring the boss bad numbers. One of the things that I found over the years that makes a difference is there isn't anybody I know who doesn't like to be asked for their advice. So when you have a legitimate reason to want to go to the boss, it's very often to either present some options or to ask for their advice about something. I also find this works very well with peers. It's extremely flattering when somebody believes that you have knowledge that they don't, or that they have knowledge that you don't. So what we've been able to do is to identify, just as we did in our first segment, some power styles that people have who are in control. And those power styles are, you know, it's not Miranda What's-Your-Face from, what was the film about the fashion? I think it was,
Devil Wears Prada.
Miranda Priestly in the Devil Wears Prada, if you want a sample of the, you know, the control freak who everybody ran away from because they were so afraid of her. I mean, she's a wonderful example of just that kind of thing.
I think played by Meryl Streep in the
By Meryl Streep, then, you know, Michael on The Office is just the opposite of that. He was completely dependent on everybody else telling him what to do. So you have these two extremes that we see in sort of our cultural norms of power. But you got to understand, just as you need to understand your own style, you got to understand their style too. And if you're able to do that, then you can become much more flexible. So want me to go through a couple of these?
Yeah, I'd appreciate it. No, I'm intrigued because I know that at least a lot of the people that even informally, people that ask me for advice, you know, clearly there's often, you know, conflict, you know, amongst peers. But, you know, look, this is all about getting ahead in your career. I think really the key is, look, if your boss doesn't see it in you, or you're not showing up, so to speak, then you're going to get, you know, you're going to be bypassed. You know,
sure.
Others will, let's say, leapfrog you. I've got somebody right now that says, hey, one of my peers who started after me at a lower salary has now just been promoted to, you know, a higher position, a director-level position. And, you know, I've been doing my job. I think I've been doing well. Well, my view is they're probably missing something somewhere along the way relative to the expectations of the boss.
I was on the phone last night with one of my executive coachees who heads a oil and gas business down in Texas, and he was preparing his performance reviews. And interestingly, he had to receive from them first how they viewed themselves. And I got to tell you, there's an enormous difference between their self-appraisal and the boss's appraisal.
Yeah.
So that lack of knowledge between the two of them is something that gap needs to be narrowed. Well, these are some of the styles that you're going to see with people. I mean, obviously, they relate very much, if you remember, our first discussion about the driver. We got somebody that we call the director. And he or she is the kind of person that is in charge, and they want to make sure that you know that they're in charge. They're motivated by power, achievement, competition, the proverbial, you know, Miranda Priestly. And the kind of things they do, they give specific instructions, they say what they think, they talk about outputs, they look at things mainly from their own perspective. So they're very self-involved. Then you've got the legitimator, and that's the person who, if you wanted to put him into the social styles, is probably analytical. Feels very comfortable about rules, regulations, dislikes taking risks. They're motivated by, you know, the need for order, for regulation. Then you've got this guy or gal called the evangelist, and they're excited about achieving something. They value loyalty, enthusiasm, dedication. They tend to talk a lot about vision. You got another individual you call the consultor. Feels decisions are best made by consulting others. They're very collaborative. They want to involve everybody. They want to have lots of discussions before they reach their conclusion. And then you have, you know, the one that everybody wants to be, and that's the empowerer. They feel most comfortable with getting others, you know, on with their way by having them do things, take risks, experiment, sometimes it's easier to seek forgiveness than permission kind of thing. So you've got these five very clear styles that you see amongst bosses. And the bottom line is you've got to deal with any one of them. So let's take the legitimator. That's the person who's fairly analytical. If you're dealing with a boss like that, then you've got to be able to cross the T's and dot the I's, develop detailed project plans, set up review meetings, give examples of how others have behaved, refer to the rules and the systems. If you got an evangelist, you have to show that you agree with their vision. You know, you need to link your views and suggestions to how they will or won't help deliver their vision. They like a structured meeting process. They like energy. They let you check the facts yourself. They don't go over your numbers. If you got a consultant, you kind of tell them, you know, what you've contributed and who else has contributed, and you need to agree on which decisions can be made and whose opinions are required. You need to communicate with them a lot. You need to frame your decisions.
And I would imagine there you want to be really careful, because some people can it can come across as if it's all about them, you know, what they've done. Even though they may talk about team, it's really putting the spotlight on themselves versus I think more importantly, you are there putting a spotlight on others.
Right,
at the same time, keeping the consultant informed.
And you're providing options. Mm-hmm. A consultant likes options. They make the final decision, but they love the fact that you come to them with an option. As opposed to the director, who basically asks your advice, or probably won't ask your advice, but that's the person to whom you ask their advice. As I said before, there isn't anybody who doesn't like to be asked for that.
Is that because they probably already have an idea?
Sure.
They've already formulated a direction?
Well, they could have an overblown opinion of their own, you know, their own worth, and so when you go to them, legends in their own minds. So,
yeah.
You know, when you go to them for advice, they're flattered by that, and you need to keep them informed, and you need to ask for clarity, and you really need to listen. And when we talk about listening, we talk about listening for facts and listening for feelings. So, what is it that he or she is not saying? What are you hearing underneath of what they're saying? And this is someone you try not to disagree with.
Mm-hmm.
The director is somebody that you want to be very careful about going up against them.
What if you find that you're working with somebody that, again, this is your boss, and that the personality is so extreme? So let's say they're, you know, they're a real driver. You know, they you know, going back to the social styles, you
sure.
know, they're a real driver. They're low context in that they don't want a lot of information. They don't want excuses. And there may be legitimate excuses as to why you can't move as fast. You know, I have a client that, a CEO client that was beating up, not in the, you know, in the metaphorical sense, but really, you know, coming down hard on one of the managers because they weren't taking action to terminate an employee. The CEO thought should be terminated, but it was, of course, the director's decision. And the CEO would come to me very frustrated, saying, "Look, I'm really upset with so and so because they're not make. There's a decision here they need to make." But when I would talk to the director, they said, "Well, you know, the CEO isn't seeing everything. What they don't see is the person is a good worker. We owe them a chance, and et cetera, et cetera." So it's very difficult when you have a very hard-driving, you know, let's say a boss, and then you've got somebody that's a little bit more low-key, a little bit more thoughtful, analytical. How would you advise somebody in that situation? Not the boss, of course, but the direct report.
Well, if you're dealing with somebody who is a driver, the best thing you could do is put together a one-page sort of a précis of what it is that you want with good rationale.
Mm-hmm.
And present that to them with an option. Say, you know, there's a situation where we need to fire somebody. I currently feel that we need to take a longer look at this person for the following three reasons.
Mm-hmm.
I think we should move forward with this plan A. If you believe, on the other hand, that the person needs to be let go, we need to be prepared to respond to any issues that come up with these 1, 2, 3 plans. In other words, it needs to be very specific, short, sweet, and to the point. And I think that the guy that or gal that you're talking about was angry about the amount of time that was taking, the slowness of the decision that had to be made rather than should it be made or not made.
Well, I think a lot of times in business it is about speed. It is about making decisions, making good decisions, and making them quickly, and then moving on. So I can see how there can be some conflict. But as you know, depending on an individual's personality, you know, think Myers-Briggs, you know, an NF or an INFP. Sorry, folks, if you're not familiar with the with that term, but you know, somebody who's going to be a little bit more circular in their decision making, they're going to be a little bit more methodical. Then, you know, again, you've got conflict. You're being pushed to do something that's really against your personality or against your grain, let's say.
Well, quick story. When I was at CBS, I was a young executive there. My boss was always on the phone because he was a powerful guy who wanted to create as much influence as he could. So he was always on the phone. But he also said, my door is always open. So every time you went to the door and put your head in, he would sort of motion you to go away or give you the wait a minute kind of sign, which was very frustrating for me. On the other hand, the next boss I had was somebody that I would run across the hall and say, do you have a minute? He would say, I can give you 1 minute now, or I can give you 10 minutes at 3 o'clock, which do you want?
I'll take the 10 minutes at 3 o'clock.
Exactly. So this was a very thoughtful guy, just as busy, you know, not driven by power, but really driven by, you know, let's be practical about this. We're all busy people. This is what I can do for you. Will you accept or not?
But if your boss pushes you hard enough, do you just acquiesce and just, okay, this is what they want. I'm going to have to just do it. Final 30-second thought.
Absolutely. And then you put your resume together and plan to move.
Oh, you really believe that?
Well, unless you're able to reason. So if you're able to reason with the boss about those things that you need, and remember the original research said, tell me what you want. So a boss really needs to know what it is that you want.
Okay.
And the bottom line is the bosses took the time to give everybody, beginning with our conversation, a manual about themselves, an owner's manual. Wouldn't it be a great world? Here's my personality, here's the things I like, here are the things that I don't like. Why don't you come back to me and give me yours?
Yeah, we don't always get that. We got to figure it out. Hey, John, listen, I wish we had more time, but I thank you so much for joining us. You've been listening to The Business of Living, and hey, make sure you join us next week. Are you a snooper? Have you ever been accused of snooping? Is it ever right to snoop on others? Is it right to snoop on your spouse, a significant other, your children? How about employees? You know, are you a snooper, and do you think that's okay? We're going to be talking about that next week when we return with The Business of Living. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for listening to The Business of Living. Please join Scott Ventrella for another edition of the show next Saturday morning at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, 11 a.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. We'll see you here next Saturday.